For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
This is more people than I expect, but you're mostly friendly faces, so that'll be good. Is there anyone here for the first time? I don't think so, no? Okay, I had kind of hoped that there would, this is a Sunday when we have an introduction to Zazen, and I had hoped we would have some first-timers so that I could provide.
I've never been here before.
Yeah. Have some tea. So I'll still give an introduction. What I've done is have a copy for everyone, I hope, of a fact.
Did you get a copy of the?
Let's see. See if I've got an extra one. Okay. You can use this one. It's not the same translation, but it'll be good. So I wanted to speak, or at least have a chance to speak with you about one of the fascicles from Dogen Shobo Genzo Kajo, which is interpreted by Kasta Hanashi as everyday activity. And the real theme of what I want to talk about is that the practice of Zen is living our life, which is something we don't do on a consistent basis across our day. We're divorced from our activities and our experience a lot of the time. We get, and you've experienced that in Zazen. I mean, you know, what percentage of a Zazen period is spent daydreaming or thinking, coming up with imaginary stories or anticipating the future and things we need to do. We imagine how things could go wrong. We keep thinking about things that happened yesterday and how we feel about that. So, and, you know, that's not just true when we're sitting on the cushion. Much of our day that we come to moment by moment, activity by activity, we see as a problem that has to be addressed so that we'll feel good and nothing bad's going to happen to us. So we walk through our day sort of distracted and sort of toggling back and forth between what's actually happening second by second, on one second, the next second, anticipating what have I got to do so that I can get what I want, or to avoid this bad thing from happening. You know, I mean, you get a letter, you open it up, and it's your son's report card, and he's had a D in math, and you go, oh my God, my children don't get D's in math. He's going to flunk out of school. He'll get hooked on drugs. He'll die in a ditch. I'll grow old and alone and penniless, and I'll die in a ditch. And you get up and you stomp down to his room, you know, in there, you'd better have your face in a book. There's not going to be any video games until you graduate from college, and it better be summa cum laude, right? Does any part of this sound familiar to anybody? But so that's kind of a good example of suffering, dukkha in Buddhism. You know, and it's There's a cluster of really three aspects to all of our suffering in Buddhism. There's what's called avidya or delusion, which is a range of things. It can be just being distracted, and it could even be a little more conceptual, not in the sense of being some sort of philosophy that we hold or that we've worked out, but assumptions about expectations we have about our life and assumptions about how it's going to work out and how our life is, and that those frameworks we have or the basis for their thoughts and emotions and our actions, And the most fundamental of those, I mean, in Buddhism, is this sense we have that we're outside of the world. Here we are, and the world is out there, and everything that's happening out there is we see as something that we have to deal with so that we get what we want, or so that nothing bad happens, so that we're always always evaluating it in whether the world and our experience measures up to our expectations. And that another aspect of suffering is the real suffering is called Trishna. Well, let me go back and say that the next aspect is Upadana, which is grasping, holding on to things. So holding on to this sense that we have about how our life is supposed to be, but we also grasping onto our thoughts and our feelings. We get caught up in them and wrapped up in those reactions and those experiences and how we're going to respond to the world. And although most of the time Buddhism talks about how we are grasping and we are attached to things, we're attached in other ways. There are plenty of times when it feels more like thoughts and feelings have attached themselves to us. They have hooks that are pulling us, and they're pulling us around, shaping all of our experience and our actions. And the third aspect is called Trishna or Tanya, which is longing and craving. It's thirst. It's what happens when you're in that distracted state and you open that letter from the school and you say, "My son got a D," and you don't go, "Well, we're going to have to work on that." You go, "Oh my God, that's upadana. That's craving. I'm going to have to fix that." You've gotten caught up in your emotional reaction, and you start acting out of that because you're wrapped up in it. So the engine that drives this, what makes this particularly hard, is karma. So I hate to say programming, but our conditioning, it comes from, who knows about biology, but certainly from culture and our experience of the world and our own activities and our own personal history, which cause us to react and just react habitually out of this conditioning. So this isn't a philosophical problem. I mean, you're not going to stop getting excited about your son's D in mathematics by saying, "Well, Nagarjuna has proven that there's really no individual human being, so there's no problem here. It's all good." That's not going to happen. And so Buddhism is not really a philosophy. It's practices. It's a way of living in order to deal with this habitual thinking and feeling and acting, all of this habitual behavior. How do we do that? And even our practice, our Buddhist practice, can get involved in this. You know, if I meditate a lot, I'll get enlightened, I'll figure things out, I'll have this transformative experience, I'll be an enlightened person, there won't be any problems anymore. Or at the very least, I'll come sit on my cushion and somehow I'll discharge all this tension I have and I'll be very calm and I can take that calmness with me throughout the day and I won't have any problems anymore. But the problem is that these are things that, you know, these are not attainments. Awakening from this behavior, from avidya and from clinging and from this longing isn't an attainment. It's not something that we get that we can carry around with us. So that sounds like a pretty bad problem. The good news, I like to say there's good news, is that this is a behavior that we engage in a lot, but we're not stuck with it all the time. There are gaps in this, and that's what our practice of Zazen is. It's a sitting and recognizing these gaps in which we're not caught up in this behavior anymore, We recognize it. We say, oh, okay, you see through it. And then you continue your activity through that. That's what sitting is. It's sitting, Zazen is sitting and waking up to this moment over and over and over again. And the thing to remember is it's not just it's an activity. Awakening, at least in Soto Zen, is something that happens in activity. So Zazen is really, it's not that we're sitting still with our legs crossed so that we can engage in some physical exercise. We really are just sitting and waking up so that we're no longer clinging, we're no longer caught up in, we're no longer distracted, we're no longer caught up in the thinking and emotions and so on. But it really is, what happens when you wake up? What happens when the gap comes? Where are you? I'm sitting. I'm right here. And this awakening is something, you know, it will go away momentarily. So this awakening is something we have to do over and over and over again across our day and in all of our activities. And that's something that Dogen, I mean all of Zen, not just Soto Zen emphasizes, but Dogen in particular makes that a real theme. I mean, we're used to talking about Dogen saying that awakening, Zazen, and the awakening in Zazen, that's our real enlightenment, and the practice of Zazen and the awakening in Zazen, that's the point. What we do is what we're aiming to do, is we're learning to just sit here, but we learn to perform all of our activities in the same way. That's what we need to do. So our ordinary life is our practice, and we practice Zen in order to live our lives. So that's really the point of this essay of Dogen's that I've passed around, Kajo, Everyday Activity. Let me just start with the first paragraph. That's, in the domain of Buddha ancestors, drinking tea and eating rice is everyday activity. This having tea and rice has been transmitted over many years and is present right now. Thus, the Buddha ancestors' vital activity of having tea and rice comes to us. So I think you probably recognize some echoes of the Dharma of thusness as intimately transmitted by Buddhas and ancestors. Now you have it. Preserve it well. But when Dogen talks about tea and rice, it's kind of significant. I mean, this is Kajo everyday activity or ordinary activity, daily life. There's an old saying that Zen practice is chopping wood and carrying water. And I don't know, Dogen must say that somewhere. I don't remember seeing it, but okay. But I think it's significant that Dogen has reached out to different stories where Zen teachers have all talked about drinking tea and eating rice, to emphasize that our awakening and our practice is just is just these ordinary activities. You know, drinking tea and eating rice is something that a monk in 13th century Japan or China would have done over and over again every day. They would have eaten rice at least three times a day. They would have had tea at each meal, and they had tea breaks in the monasteries as well. So, you know, this is just an ordinary, very common activity. And equating that with the Buddha ancestors' activities is kind of interesting too, isn't it? I mean, we think of Buddhas as having these enormous powers. They're living in their Buddha realms. They have perfected, skillful means. They have tremendous powers. And yet, the exercise of the perfection of skillful means and the powers of a Buddha is eating rice and drinking tea, their everyday activity. So that's a key. We have the same powers as the Buddha ancestors. So I also think it's significant when you say, when he chooses eating rice and drinking tea is the example of an everyday activity, which is the expression of our awakening, because he is saying that this everyday activity is something that nourishes us, that fulfills our spiritual hunger, and that ends this craving that we bring to our life. So we'll leave that and move on to the next paragraph. I'm not going to read the whole thing. We don't have enough time for that. You'd get bored before we got to the end anyway. But I think this introduction will help you. If you take it home, I think it'll be interesting to be able to read it. I want to also say that, which I've tried to hint at already, is that when one of the things that Dogen does is something that he here is the something he does in other fascicles as well. So eating rice and drinking tea is synecdoche, right? It's you give it a specific example that stands for the rest of it's part of the entire group. So eating rice and drinking tea, sometimes he's saying using that as a phrase that stands for all of our daily activities. Other times he literally means eating rice and drinking tea. And part of Dogen as a literary artist is that there's a tension there where he goes back and forth and plays with that. And sometimes he's literal, and in being literal, he means to include all of our activities as well. So let's read that first longer section, and I want to apologize in advance for the way I'm going to pronounce the Chinese, because I haven't had lessons in Chinese pronunciation. So anyway, so ignore it. Priest Daokai of Mount Dayang asked Dozu, "It is said that the thoughts and words of Buddha ancestors are everyday tea and rice. Besides this, are there any words or phrases for teaching?" And Dozu said, "Tell me, when the emperor issues a decree in his territory, does he send Emperor Yu, Tang, Yao, or Shun?" As Dayang was about to, and so Emperors Yu, Tang, Yao, and Shun are ancient, are old former emperors. So the question is, okay, if the before, you know, does our current emperor, does he go get them before he undertakes any activities? So as Dayang was about to open his mouth, Dozu covered it with his whisk. "While you were thinking, you've already received 30 blows." Dayang was then awakened. He bowed deeply and began to leave. And Dozu said, "Wait, Reverend." Dayang did not turn around, and Dozu said, "Have you reached the ground of no doubt?" Dayang covered his ears with his hands and left. "And from this, you should clearly understand that the thoughts and words of Buddha ancestors are their everyday tea and rice. Ordinary coarse tea and plain rice are Buddha's thoughts, ancestors' words. Because Buddha ancestors prepare rice and tea, tea and rice maintain Buddha ancestors accordingly. They need no powers other than this tea and rice, and they have no need to use powers as Buddha ancestors. You should investigate and study the expression. Does he need Emperor Yu, Tang, Yao, or Shun? You should leap over the summit of the question. Besides tea and rice, are there any words or phrases for teaching? You should try to see whether leaping is possible or not." So, I mean, the first point is clearly that just every activity, awakened activity, drinking tea, eating rice, are the true fundamental expression of awakened mind, not a description. And so when he's, you know, the story is, well, if the emperor is going to ask, do you ask for Yu, Dang, Yao, or Shun? Do you ask these ancients to take care of the problem for you? And the same thing he's saying, well, Dozu is saying, why are you asking me, why are you talking about the words of these Buddha ancestors and these old Zen masters? I mean, you're right now, you're right here. Instead of talking about awakening, just awaken right now. What is that all about? That's eating rice and drinking tea. Eating rice and drinking tea are the expression of your awakening. There are no other powers. There's no other awakening separate from this activity here and now. You need to leap over this thinking that's trying to explain to yourself and what awakening is. And you have to stop thinking about what these ancestors said and simply eat rice and drink tea. So, then in the next paragraph we have Great Master Wuji of Shito Hut, Mount Nanyue, said, "I have built a grass hut where no coins are kept. Having had rice, I'm ready for a leisurely nap." Right? This is from the Song of the Grass Hut. Having had rice, words come, words go, words come and go, filled with Buddha ancestors, thoughts and words. Not to have rice is not to be filled. Yet the point of having had rice and a leisurely nap is actualized before having rice, while having rice, and after having rice. To understand that having rice lies only in the domain of having had rice is the mere study of four or five show of rice. So there he's playing with the whole idea that of eating rice is literally eating rice. But if eating rice is just, if you just mean eating rice, and that's what you think that the story is about, that's just not much rice. It's just four or five show of rice, a couple of gallons of rice. It's not going to feed the monastery. What I like is when he plays with that the point of having had rice in a leisurely nap is actualized before having rice, while having rice, and after having rice. You know, the whole point is that in cooking the rice, if you cook the rice, that also is the same as being awake to the cooking of the rice. That satisfies your hunger, your spiritual hunger then. Eating the rice, you have to be awake to eating the rice to satisfy your hunger. After having eaten the rice, your stomach is full, but your spirit is also satisfied. My late master, old Buddha, taught the assembly, "I heard that a monk asked Bajang, 'What is an extraordinary thing?' And Bajang said, 'Sitting alone on Dashong Peak, the assembly cannot move him, for now let him totally sit.' Today, if someone were to ask me, 'What is an extraordinary thing?' I would say, 'Is anything extraordinary? Do you know what it means? The bowl of Jingzi has moved. I'm having rice in Tiantong.'" So that's just the bowl that he used in one monastery, he's still using when he eats rice in the other monastery. In the domain of Buddha ancestors, there's always something extraordinary. Sitting alone on Daoshang Peak, being allowed to totally sit is itself an extraordinary thing. Even more extraordinary is, the bowl of Jingzi has moved. I'm having rice in Tiantong. Each and every extraordinary activity is simply having rice. The sitting alone on Daoshang Peak is just having rice. The monk's bowl is used for having rice, and what is used for having rice is the monk's bowl. Therefore, it is the bowl of Jingzi, and it is having rice in Tiantong. Being filled is to know rice. Eating rice is to be filled. To know is to be filled with rice. To be filled is to continue eating. Now, what is the monk's bowl? I say it's not wood, and it's not black lacquer. Is it an immovable rock? Is it an iron person? It's bottomless. It has no nostrils. One mouth swallows the empty sky. The empty sky is received with palms together. So there he's making explicit that when he's talking about eating rice and drinking tea, he's talking about all of our activities. That this eating rice and drinking tea has to fill all of our life, our everyday activity throughout the day. But I also like the idea that he says, okay, Bajang has done this great thing. He's been up on top of a mountain, living in his hermitage, sitting until he's very, very, very hard. He's ready to die. It's an extraordinary thing. But it's no more extraordinary than just eating rice and drinking tea. When you come down to it, sitting on top of a mountain and doing lots and lots and lots of zazen is not fundamentally different from eating, cooking rice, eating rice, drinking tea, sweeping the zendo, whatever other activities there are. But this eating rice and drinking tea fills the entire universe. It's fundamentally true and real and subsumes the entire universe of activity. Let's jump to the end. I like the last story. This is one that... Dogen. It's the last story. Taigen spoke about this story in the past week. Zhaozhou, great master Zenji, asked a newly arrived monk, "Have you been here before?" And the monk said, "Yes, I've been here." And the master said, "Have some tea." Again, he asked another monk, "Have you been here before?" And the monk said, "No, I haven't been here." And the master said, "Have some tea." The temple director then asked the master, "Why do you say have some tea to someone who's been here and have some tea to someone who has not?" And the master said, "Director." And when the director responded, the master said, "Have some tea." Zhaozhou's "here" then does not mean the top of the head, the nostrils, or Zhaozhou, since "here" leaps off "here." A monk said, "I have been here." And another said, "I've not been here." It means, "What is now?" I only say, "I've been here. I've not been here." Therefore, my late master said, "In your picture of the wine shop, who faces you drinking Zhaozhou's tea?" Thus, the everyday activity of Buddha ancestors is nothing but having tea and rice. So, for the inexperienced, we have the inexperienced monk, and Zhaozhou says, "Have you been here before?" He didn't mean, "Have you been to my monastery before?" He meant, "Have you been here? Do you live here? Are you awake to what you're doing now?" And when he said, "No, I haven't been here," he says, "Okay, you need to drink. Come with me. We need to drink tea." The experienced monk says, "Yes, I've been here." And, he has been here. He also knows what Zhaozhou is talking about. But this doesn't mean, "Okay, well, then you can go, because you've already had tea." No. Once you've drunk tea, once you've done this one before, this is something you continue to do. Let's drink tea together. This is a practice of every activity that we engage in together. We awaken together throughout our lives. That's why we sit zazen as a group. Other Buddhist traditions, for the most part, people go off in a room by themselves or a hut and practice by themselves. We awaken together in the zendo. We work together. So, that's the flavor of our school of Buddhism. So I want to just leave it here, and maybe we'll have some time to talk, ask questions about this. Thank you. Yeah.
According to what arises from zazen. But I just thought it was really reminding me of that.
Yeah, and I think, the practice of Nyoho, as you say, it's very much activity. And recognizing that the ordinary activity is extraordinary or even miraculous, and that we honor each activity and honor the things that support our practice. And so in some monasteries, you know, they're not wasting everything. You get a dipper of water, you don't drink the whole dipper, you put some back. You tear your robes, you don't throw out your robes, you fix your robes. When finally your robes are worn out, you might have a funeral for your robes. You honor the everyday things and the activities in your everyday life. And that's something that's harder for us to do when we're not in that structured environment, I think, in our ordinary life as lay people. But it's something we can keep in mind, but it's harder to do, I think.
I'm not sure. I mean, I think that's a good question. Is it harder? Like, I think there are ways you can arrange life, like our life here. We're not a monastery, but we have this temple that's set up in a particular way. We wear our clothing in a particular way, you know, and that clothing could be a hoodie. You know, like I feel like that, like it's it, everything that we have becomes this expression from our practice. You know, so I mean, yes, you could say it's easier, you know, in some ways, but like it's really hard to be Oriyoki style. It's like really complicated. You know, or I'm always like with all the robes on, it's almost harder. You know, to move around. You know, I'd rather wear this.
But having those robes on and eating Oriyoki does require you to pay attention and exercise care when you dress and when you eat. I think it's easier, I just think as lay people, it's easier for us to get more distracted. And we don't have the support. We don't have people reminding us, wake up, wake up, wake up, come back. Yes.
So last summer I had this wonderful opportunity to visit Tassajara Monastery for a short time. And of course there was a lot of sitting and chanting and all kinds of things. But the part that I felt the most awake during and that I remember most powerfully is the 3 hours we spent in the morning in work period in the kitchen chopping vegetables and fruit. Very, very precisely according to directions, in silence with a group of other people who were also chopping vegetables and fruit very precisely. And it, you know, there was a bracelet of different sizes of pieces of wood, so you were told which size piece of wood you would chop vegetables according to. And
that's ingenious.
Exactly which tools to use and exactly which way to put it. And it was a wonderful awakening experience. I can't describe it any other way. And it is exactly what you described, which was looking, you know, activity together. And it, you know, you weren't thinking about the recipe that your particular, you know, squash cubes were going to go into. You were just really thinking about, or not even thinking about, being in the squash cubes. So, anyway, my example of your talk.
John?
Yeah, thanks for your talk. Really hit home in a lot of ways for me, but I was wondering about the ambition. Ambition grasping, or I mean, I was thinking ahead. You may have the ambition to get a better job, to do more for your family, or to have more time with your family, or have the ambition to come here less irregularly.
I think it depends on how you experience that intention. I mean, all of our life is intentional. It's when we react out of that grasping. When we experience something longing, there's a difference between somebody who's saying, well, it would be a good thing for me and my family, I'd be very interested in having a different job. It's something different to say, I really want to be a movie star. You know, it's a difference. It's a psychological difference. And so, you know, I mean, I don't think that, I think that's what you have to keep in mind. And you could have both, depending on, at one moment you are imagining it in a certain way, and another you're here and thinking about what a good idea, whether or not it would be a good idea, and planning for that. We don't turn into lumps through practice.
I was having a similar thought with respect to discussing, you know, having had rice. I saw some statistic that, like, somewhere between a half and two-thirds of one's enjoyment of vacation is in the anticipation of vacation. And, you know, maybe there's still, like, another six left, you know, for the after enjoyment of vacation. But, and so it's kind of like having had rice. You know, it exists before, it exists during, it exists after. We don't, in our anticipation of vacation, we don't anticipate, you know, some of the things that could happen on vacation. Like, you know, we don't anticipate that we're going to, you know, go totally off at the bellhop when our room isn't ready on time, you know? And, so it's like, I don't know that there's something wrong about anticipating, you know? It's how do we use those experiences?
Yeah.
Can we be awake throughout anticipating something that's going to happen, throughout, you know, happening it when it's happening, and, you know, and afterwards, and how do we do that? I think it's sort of the central question of this.
Yeah. Well, and being awake. I mean, the clinging loses its force when we're awake. I mean, but they're inseparable, right? I mean, you only become awake because you've stopped clinging when you're awake, and you say, okay, I'm going to be here, the clinging stops. And it's the difference between, okay, I'm going to vacation in Florida in September. Maybe I should make some plans for what I'm going to do if a hurricane comes, as opposed to make your reservations and then you spend the next 3 months wondering, oh my God, there's going to be a hurricane. What am I going to do? There's a difference, right? One is maybe having tea and rice while you plan your vacation. The other is not eating rice.
We're actually living our life right now while we're anticipating our vacation.
Yeah.
Can our anticipation of vacation also be part of our life right now?
Sure. Yeah.
Just to respond to two wonderful questions. John's question, what is right ambition? And what is right anticipation? How do we practice that? So if you have some ambition and you're, as Dr. said, you're clinging to it and you have to have, you know, some particular outcome, that's a trap, that's suffering. But we can have, you know, some goal or some aspiration which have the bodhisattva vows of free all beings. That's pretty ambitious. How do we take on trying to live our life in a constructive way, take care of our family and so forth, but without holding on to some particular outcome that it has to be, and being flexible enough to see what's going on, what's actually going on. According to Dharma, as an example, according to the reality of what's happening. So that way, your ambition can be not grasping, but just a way of living. So again, I think it's a subtle question, what is right ambition? And I think Asian kind of answered what is right anticipation is that we're not, again, not attached to some particular outcome, because nothing ever happens according to our expectation. I'm sure this is not the talk that was exactly expected it to be. Maybe pretty close.
No.
But anyway, nothing happens.
Yeah.
reality is beyond our expectations, anticipations, ambitions, and how do we just accord with this reality? Other comments or questions about this?
Brian.
This business of being present in every activity, I certainly know what it's like to be caught up in the thoughts and doing something at the same time and not really being there. Sometimes when I say, okay, I'm really going to be here, there's this self-consciousness of here I am cleaning this floor. I'm having this experience cleaning this floor, and it's more about my experience of it than before. And I wonder whether, rather than self-consciousness, it's more like losing oneself in the activity itself. It's identifying with as the floor rather than as the person who is trying to be present.
Yeah, I don't know about losing yourself in the activity, and people like to talk a lot about flow sometimes, and in sports, flow is, it's the same as practicing Zen, and I don't think that's necessarily true, but there's certainly a difference between acknowledging here I am and paying attention while you work as opposed to paying attention as some sort of technique. This isn't a technique. There are things that help. I mean, obviously, okay, I'm going to stand up, I'm going to sit up straight and things like that. But, you know, it's just like Zazen isn't really about being aware of your breath or counting your breath and getting to 10 without getting lost for 35 minutes. It's really about sitting here. And part of sitting here is, you know, you're breathing and you are aware of that breathing. And I think that what happens is when we do work practice and we want to be awake, we say, okay, I'm here, and then work. And then you'll have another, okay, I'm here, now I'm going to work. I'm going to sweep the floor, mop the floor. Rather than try to be very careful about being very aware and very precise about the way I'm sweeping or mopping the floor, that sort of thing. And then it's something, it's different. Then it's, you haven't awakened from the mental activity, you've gotten caught in a mental activity again.
Thank you for a great talk and great discussion. We can close with the four 47
Bing Zar.